Good morning.
Good morning.
And welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Congregation of the South Fork. All who come here are welcome. My name is John Andrews. I have been a member of the spiritual community for a little over 10 years now. And for those of you intrepid folks who came out again for Sunday morning after yesterday's wonderful ordination, glad to see you. And we're going to have a good service today. And I want to thank Nancy Rempis for sharing her musical gifts with us this morning. And I'm also grateful to Slim Moon, who's came all the way from Washington State for the ordination yesterday, and will be talking to us today about radical welcome. He's a ministerial candidate who lives, he says, right across the Columbia River from Portland, and graduated from Meadville Lombard Theological School, serves the Church of the Larger Fellowship, which, if you don't know what that is, it's an arm of the UU that enables people who are either shut in or live too far from a congregation to attend service to actually have services online. The other thing is that before answering the call to ministry, Slim spent his adult life as an entrepreneur in the independent music business. So that's quite a combination. Yeah. Now, ours is a shared minister. Our minister, we've been calling her the Reverend Kimberly Quinn Johnson, but I guess strictly speaking, she only became the Reverend yesterday. But however that might be, she now is the Reverend Kimberly Quinn Johnson. She leads worship 2 or 3 times a month, and other Sundays the service is led by worship associates, members, and guest speakers. And our services are different from week to week, so if you're new to the congregation, come early and come often, as they say in Boston. I don't see anybody new here, but welcome all. And I call your attention to the announcements printed on the insert in your order of service. Kimberly asked me to mention that we're not having religious exploration today, but we will have it again next week. And finally, zap off your cell phones or whatever so they don't go ding-a-ding-a-ding during the service.
Everyone, everywhere, going out and coming.
Perhaps I should have said it, just between the wine and grace, the wishing and the blessing. That was a time for words, when the scene had just begun, before we passed the dressing. I might have paused, looked up, and all around into the eyes of each of them. A jest came easier, wit tossed into the sound and lost. Between the stuffing and the pie was yet another quiet moment when I could have told them all. Instead, I sighed and let it pass. Just once before the end, I should have cried, "Listen, before you go, I love you. I just wanted you to know." The words of Peter LaForge. As we light our chalice, the symbol of our spiritual tradition of free minds and open hearts, let us say together the words of our mission and vision that are printed on the back of your order of service. We are a spiritual community.
We honor every individual's search for truth and meaning. We act against exclusion, oppression, and violence. We nurture the health of the earth. We strive for peace in our hearts and the world around us. When fear strikes, we stand on the side of love.
I invite you now to rise in body or spirit to join in singing hymn number 1008 in your teal hymnal, "When Our Heart Is in a Holy Place."
Out walking one morning, I saw a medium-sized turtle begin the dangerous journey across the road from one side of Monponset Pond to the other. The traffic is pretty heavy, even at 6 a.m., and as the turtle left the safety of the roadside grasses, I looked right and could see a line of cars coming, led by a Harley Davidson, ridden by a leather-clad figure in a tinted plexiglass helmet. The turtle was almost halfway point, destined for extinction beneath those burning wheels. I moved a few paces into the road and simply pointed to the turtle. The motorcyclist slowed, bringing his gleaming bike to a stop. He put out his arm to indicate to the cars behind him that they should not overtake. He allowed the turtle to cross in safety. Then he and I signaled a greeting to each other and went on our ways. The turtle, the motorcyclist, and I were on different journeys that day, and mine was a journey of discovery. I discovered that compassion sometimes wears a motorcycle helmet. I found the place inside me that fears bikers, and I made a few corrections. I don't know what kind of day the turtle had, or the person on the motorcycle, but my day was better for having encountered them.
Let us read together the words of Lao Tse, number 602, in the Gray Hymnal. And when we were the group that was working on our mission vision statement, we were inspired by this particular reading to generate the fifth sentence. And you'll see why. I'll read the Roman type, and if you'd respond with the italics. If there is to be peace in the world,
there must be peace in the nations.
If there is peace in the nations,
there must be peace in the cities.
If there is to be peace in the cities,
there must be peace between neighbors.
If there is to be peace between neighbors,
there must be peace in the home.
If there is to be peace in the home,
there must be peace in the heart.
Let us enter a time of meditation. Please remain seated in meditation mode, and we will start with hymn number 1005 in your teal hymnal, appropriately enough, Meditation on Breathing.
1009.
Whoops, 1000, I'm sorry, I got the number wrong. 1009. The discipline of blessings is to taste each moment, the bitter, the sour, the sweet, and the salty, and be glad for what does not hurt. The art is in compressing attention to each little and big blossom of the tree of life, to let the tongue sing each fruit, its savor, its aroma, and its use. Words by Marge Piercy. I'm happy to have Slim Moon here today, who's going to talk to us about Shakespeare in the Bush and Radical Welcome.
I suppose most of you were here yesterday. I loved what Alison Miller had to say about the challenge of welcoming and the challenge of changing the church to be welcoming. And this eventually, it takes a while, but that's sort of where we get to in this sermon. I'm really glad to, I got to come out here for that, and I really love this congregation. This is my third time here, and there's nowhere I'd rather be on a Sunday. You can hear the birds, and it's just the kind of congregation that I really love, you folks. Can everybody hear me okay? It was the year 1950. Laura Bohannon was an anthropologist living in England. She and a friend were discussing the recent plays of William Shakespeare that they had both seen, because there was a festival going on. And her friend said, "You Americans," I'm not gonna do an English accent, "you Americans often have difficulty with Shakespeare. He was, after all, a very English poet. And one can easily misinterpret the universal by misunderstanding the particular." But Laura Bohannon disagreed. She said, "Human nature is pretty much the same all over the world. Some details of custom might have to be explained, but at least the general plot and the motivation of the greater tragedies, would be clear everywhere." Her English friend just laughed and gave her a copy of Hamlet. So a few months later, she was in an extremely remote bush region of West Africa where the Tiv people lived. One day during the rainy season, when she was sitting in a reception hut of the patriarch of the homestead, as he was telling her some of the ancient stories and ceremonies of his culture. Other elders were huddled around the central fire, some laying on plank beds, some sitting on stools, and reclining chairs. They were all drinking homemade millet beer. "You should sit and drink with us more often," said the old man. "I know that when you are not with us, you sit inside your hut looking at a piece of paper." "The paper is a story," she said, one of the things of long ago of my country." "Ah," said the old man, "tell us this story. No one will criticize your style. We know you are struggling with our language." And one of the other elders spoke up. "But you must explain what we do not understand, as we do when we tell you our stories." She realized that this was her chance to prove that the themes of Shakespeare are universal. So she began to tell the story. And she attempted to tell it in the style of the TIV storytellers. Not yesterday, but long ago, a thing occurred. One night, three men were keeping watch outside the homestead of the great chief, when suddenly they saw the former chief approach them. The old man interrupted. "Why was he no longer chief?" "He was dead," she explained. "That is why they were troubled and afraid when they saw him." "Impossible," said one of the elders. "Of course it wasn't the dead chief. It was an omen sent by a witch. Go on." She continued. "One of these three was a man who knew things. So he spoke to the dead chief, saying, 'Tell us what we must do so you may rest in your grave.' But the dead chief did not answer. He vanished, and they could see him no more. Then the man who knew things, his name was Horatio, said this event was the affair of the dead chief's son, Hamlet. There was a general shaking of heads around the circle. 'An affair of the son? Had the dead chief no living brothers?' someone asked. 'Or was his son the new chief?' 'No,' Bohannon said. 'That is, he had one living brother who had become the chief when the elder brother died.' The old man muttered, 'Such omens were matters for chiefs and elders, not for youngsters. No good could come of going behind the chief's back.' Clearly, Horatio was not a man who knew things." "Yes, he was," Bohannon insisted. "In our country, the son is next to the father. The dead chief's younger brother had become the great chief, and he had also married the elder brother's widow only about a month after the funeral." "He did well," the old man beamed and announced to the others. "I told you that if we knew more about Europeans, we would find that they are very much like us. In our country also, the younger brother marries the elder brother's widow and becomes the father of his children." Now Bohannon started to see that she was going to have some difficulty. To the American or the English audience, it is suspicious or scandalous that the brother of the dead king married the widow. But to the TIV elders, that's exactly what should have happened. Bohannon took a deep breath and began again. The son Hamlet was very sad because his mother had married again so quickly. There was no need for her to do so. And it is our custom for a widow not to go to her next husband until she has mourned for 2 years. Suddenly, the wife of the patriarch spoke up. 2 years is too long. Who will hoe your fields for you while you have no husband?" Okay, so let's leave off that story for a minute. The reason I'm telling this story is because it's one of my favorite examples of people trying to share the understanding of the meaning of making and trying to make meaning together. And it's important because sharing the making of meaning is one of the main things that we do at church, that we do in religious work. Part of my training to become a minister, I spent a summer being a chaplain, learning how to be a chaplain in a hospital. And the biggest thing that they teach us, and what I found the work of a chaplain to do, is to help people get to their religious and spiritual beliefs as part of figuring out the meaning of what is happening to them when they're suffering loss or changes in life. And church and religion, one of the types of meaning making that we work on, of course, that we deal with, is faith. So I asked the question, what does faith mean for Unitarian Universalists? A lot of people use the word faith to indicate certainty. Like, I have faith in the government. I have faith that my mother loves me. A lot of people in religious uses use faith to indicate belief in ideas and ideals that are and super beliefs in ideas and ideals and supernatural things. There's a famous line from the book of Hebrews: faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. A lot of churches and pastors use the word faith this way, as another word for certainty. But the origin of the word faith as a religious word in the West actually has a very different meaning. It wasn't about belief. The Hebrew word for faith is a relational action word that means firm support. And this concept of support went both directions. To have faith in God meant to be committed to God and also to be supported by God. And I like this understanding of the word faith. What we have faith in is both the thing that we are committed to and the thing that gives us support. And you can see that in the word faithful. Like, I am faithful to my wife, I am faithful to my family. It's both the thing you are committed to and the thing you get support from. And so that's the question. What does it mean to be a faithful Unitarian Universalist? You could say, what are we committed to and what gives us support? In Unitarian Universalism, there's a dynamic tension between the individual and community. One of the foundational documents, as probably most of you know, is the Seven Principles. These principles acknowledge the interdependent web of all existence, and they insist upon democracy and community and acceptance of others. But they also speak of the worth and dignity of the individual and the free individual search for truth and meaning, which many interpret to mean that we are a community of rugged individualists and nonconformers. So considering this dynamic tension, I want to ask a question about the question. When I ask, what are you committed to and what gives you support? Did you find yourself thinking, what is the community committed to and what gives the community support? Or did you find yourself thinking, what are you individually committed to and what gives you support? To go deeper in your faith, do you commit to what the community is committed to? Or do you seek to examine just what you are personally committed to? And I think the answer should be both. I mean, the point of church is that we come together as a community and we do meaningful things together. And the fact that we're here today singing hymns and reciting readings and pondering faith, that's a meaningful community activity. We might be able to do each of those things at home. You could sing a hymn at home by yourself, but it just wouldn't have the same meaning. The way it supports us together is different than the way we would be supported individually. And I'm sure that the worship services are only one part of what this congregation does. You probably do some religious education, some faith formation or classes and speakers. And you probably work for justice and peace in the world. I bet you that's a safe bet. No matter how big or small your involvement is, to show up here and to take part in church is an act of faith, a personal commitment to those things, to peace and justice and freedom, that this community is committed to and supported by. And commitment to church should be met with the understanding that the other people in the church will support you. When members of the community experience suffering and loss, they rightfully can look to the community for support. For those of you here who are hurting right now, our faith means you have the right to ask for support. Life is hard, and everyone needs compassion. Doesn't matter how together, how lucky, how blessed people are, they're gonna need compassion at times. It'd be best if we all gave God compassion and understanding all the time. But especially, we have a right to it when we're hurting, and community is one of the places we should be able to get it. We're not a faith that asks every participant to agree to a list of propositional statements. We're not a faith that asks everyone to conform in order to come in the door or in order to stay. We are a faith that we know that everyone comes with our own individual experiences. We come from a beautiful variety of different contexts. We have different frameworks. And yet we come together and do things together and we make meaning together. We're a faith that knows that we are made stronger because of our diversity, because we have different ways of seeing and being. And that's why I believe we're a faith that wants to practice radical welcome. because we know that our commitment to diversity is one of our great strengths. Diversity means exposure to ideas that we'd never think of on our own. If you get a bunch of people who are really similar, you're only going to get one set of ideas. If you get people from different contexts and backgrounds, you're going to get a better picture. And that's why I chose this story this morning, because it's hard when people come together from different backgrounds and different contexts, and it's beautiful and it makes us stronger, but it can be really hard to understand each other. And that's why I picked this story. So getting back to the story, Bohannon spent the rest of that morning telling the story of Hamlet, and she discovered at every turn of the story that the elders had questions she never anticipated, and they vigorously argued with her about the meaning of each event. She told them that the ghost of Hamlet's father said that the big chief Claudius had poisoned him. She told him about the important elder, Polonius, and that Hamlet was courting his daughter, Ophelia, and about how Hamlet was banished from seeing Ophelia, and that many people thought he'd gone mad because he couldn't see her. "Why would anyone bewitch Hamlet on that account?" the elders asked. They explained to her that only witchcraft can make a person mad or crazy. Only Hamlet's relatives in the male line have the ability to bewitch him into madness. So it had to be Claudius who was attempting to harm him. And if you know the play Shakespeare, it actually was Claudius that was attempting to harm him, although they arrived at it a really different reason. Bohannon told them that Polonius hid behind a cloth hanging on the wall while Hamlet spoke to his mother. When Polonius moved, Hamlet took his machete and slashed through the cloth. And then he discovered he had killed Polonius, thinking that it was the great chief. Elders were seriously shocked by this. One of them said, "For a man to raise his hand against his father's brother and the one who has become his father, that is a terrible thing. The elders ought to let such a man become bewitched." "But no," said pronounced the chief, the elder, "if your father's brother has killed your father, you must appeal to your father's age mates. You can't kill him yourself. You have to get your father's age mates to do the vengeance. No man may use violence against an older relative." Another thought struck him. "But if this father's brother had indeed been wicked enough to bewitch Hamlet and make him crazy, so that would be a good story indeed, because Hamlet no longer had any sense, and thus was ready, and that's why he was ready to kill his father's brother, even though everybody knows that that's not done. So it's his fault, because he made Hamlet crazy." And there was a murmur of applause. The elders again agreed that Hamlet was a good story. But to Bohannon, it felt like it was no longer the same story. She told them of how Ophelia went mad and drowned herself because Hamlet had killed Polonius, and how Laertes swore to get revenge on Hamlet. And again, the old men disagreed. They said, "You can't take vengeance on a madman. Hamlet killed Polonius in his madness. As for the girl, she not only went mad, she was drowned. And everybody knows that only witches can drown people, because water itself can't hurt anything. As we explained before, only relatives of the male line can bewitch someone. So it must have been Laertes who killed Ophelia." "Listen," said the elder, "and I will tell you how it was and how your story will go. Then you can tell me if I am right. Polonius knew his son would get into trouble, and he did. He probably had many fines to pay for fighting and debts from gambling. But he had only two ways of getting money quickly. One was to marry off his sister at once, but it is difficult to find a man who will marry a woman who is desired by the son of a chief. For if the chief's heir commits adultery with your wife, what can you do? Only a fool calls a case against the man who will someday be his judge. Therefore, Laertes had to take the second way. He killed his sister by witchcraft, drowning her so he could secretly sell her body to the witches." Bohannon raised an objection. "They found her body and buried it. Indeed, Laertes jumped into the grave to see his sister once more. So you see, the body was truly there. Nobody sold it. Hamlet, who had just come back, jumped in after Laertes into the grave." "What did I tell you?" the elder said. "Laertes was up to no good with his sister's body. Hamlet prevented him because the chief's heir, like a chief, does not wish any other man to grow rich and powerful. Laertes would be angry because he would have killed his sister and not in the end benefited himself. In our country, he would try to kill Hamlet for that reason. Is that not what happened? Bohannon had to sheepishly agree that Laertes did try to kill Hamlet. She told the story of their machete fight and of how Hamlet's mother drank poison, and of how as Hamlet was dying, he killed Laertes and the great chief, Claudius. "You see, I was right," said the elder. So this is my caution, and the thing that I hope this story can make clear. To come together and to be committed to each other, and to help each other make sense and meaning out of our stories, to pursue what it means to be a faithful Unitarian Universalist, to support each other in the things that are most important, we must know that we aren't working to discover one universal truth, and then once we've found it, convince everybody else of that. Faith isn't about comfort. Being committed to diversity means that we may have to re-examine our own beliefs, and we may have to open our doors to new thoughts and new ideas, things that may even make us uncomfortable. Too often in Unitarian Universalism, we think of radical welcome as meaning that others are welcome to come and be changed by us. But radical welcome means others are welcome to come and we are willing and ready and able to be changed by them. And that's the kind of faith I'm talking about. That's the way we become more supported and supportive as a community. When we're able to learn and see new truths that only those who are different from us can see. Laura Bohannon told the Tiv elders the story of Hamlet because she believed that the story was universal. She thought she knew what it meant, and she was going to teach it to those people who were very different. But by the end of the story, she had to admit that the meaning was not universal, and the wise old men had shown her another meaning. And that's the way things happen in a pluralistic, diverse, multicultural rainbow world. That's how it should be. As she got up to go, the old man spoke one last time. "That was a very good story," he said. "And you told it with only a few mistakes. Sometime you must tell us more stories of your country. We, who are the elders, will instruct you in their true meaning, so that when you go to your own land, your elders will see that while you were here among those who know things, while you were among those who know things, and we have taught you wisdom." Thank you.
Thank you, Slim. Let us rise in body or spirit now to sing hymn number 108 in your gray hymnal, "My Life Flows On." Please remain standing as we say the words to extinguish our chalice printed in your order of service. We extinguish this flame,
but not the light of truth, the warmth of community, or the fire of commitment. These we carry in our hearts until we are together again.
And I invite you now to reach out to those nearby, holding hands or touching a shoulder, to feel the sense of community we all share while we listen to the words of Rebecca Ann Parker. Your gifts, whatever you discover them to be, can be used to bless or to curse the world. The mind's power, the strength of the hands, the reaches of the heart, the gift of speaking, listening, imagining, seeing, waiting. Any of these can serve to feed the hungry, bind up wounds, welcome the stranger, praise what is sacred, do the work of justice, or offer love. Any of these can draw down the prison door, hoard bread, abandon the poor, obscure what is holy, comply with injustice, or withhold love. You must answer this question: what will you do with your gifts? Choose to bless the world.
We will rise all together. We will beautiful day.